What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting! From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Do we have fake news because we live in a fake democracy? Should we blame hostile foreign powers and tech giants like Facebook and YouTube for the spread of mis- and disinformation? These are the questions answered by this week's guest, Marcus Gilroy Ware. In conversation with Richard Seymour, they have a wide-ranging conversation about the roots of fake news and why, to understand this phenomenon, we have to go much deeper than our general discussions in the mainstream media. It's a fascinating conversation, and if you do enjoy it, you can find a link for Marcus's book in the podcast description. But now let's go to the episode.
Hello and welcome to this Intelligence Squared podcast with me, Richard Seymour. I'm delighted to welcome our guest today, Marcus Gilroy Ware. He is a senior lecturer in digital journalism at the School of Film and Journalism, University of the West of England, and author of After the Fact, The Truth About Fake News. Welcome, Marcus. This book, following from your previous, Filling the Void, it seems to continue a basic theme, which is our subjection to technologies of power that exploit our vulnerabilities and our emotional needs. But although it's about fake news, it's not like some of the other books about it. It doesn't blame Russia or Facebook or Twitter or postmodernism or anything like that. If anything, you seem to be saying we have fake news because we live in a fake democracy. So I suppose the first question is quite general. Why did you want to write about this subject of fake news, and why in this way? Why do we live in a fake democracy, and why does that leave us so informationally disempowered?
Well, I'm really glad you picked up on that, actually, because fake news or fake democracy was literally the kind of motto that was going around in my head as I was thinking about this book and trying to write it. And it was sort of scrawled across the whiteboard in my old flat as I was sort of grinding the book out. I think with my previous book, Filling the Void, I had already gotten kind of, there's a bit towards the end where I was trying to make sense of Trump winning the election. And I felt that there was a lot of kind of avoidance of some painful truths around what had happened to, you know, Western democracy. That meant that the sort of most useful explanations for how that could have happened were avoided at the expense of finding kind of, you know, more simple answers, as you say, blaming the Russians, blaming Facebook, etc. Not that there's no culpability in respect of those things necessarily, but that they were easier and simpler narratives to tell. And so I wanted to write a second book that was really kind of about that process of choosing simpler narratives. And, you know, why that happens. What are the pressures in our culture that drive us to do that? And where do they come from? And then I felt that there was a kind of a pleasing circularity in the sense that, whereas, you know, with the first book, I was just talking about, you know, some of the issues with social media. The second time around, I felt like if you're critiquing the narrative, you're sort of making, in a way, you're making a criticism of the narratives we have about information itself. In other words, the narrative about the narrative. And so when all of these kinds of things started to be said about how bad fake news is and how important the truth is and all these kinds of, again, simplistic and misleading, in some cases, stories about what was happening in the world, I wanted to kind of to try to say, well, actually, you have your answer there. You know, that the kind of cheap, simple stories you're telling yourself about what has happened are part of the reason that we have gotten to this predicament, that we've gotten to a world that appears to be falling apart because we have refused to kind of really engage with those more complicated and multifaceted and difficult truths that involve our own complicity in the problems that we're now seeing.
Okay, so, I mean, we're complicit, and that's an interesting theme I want to take up in a moment. But can I just get you to describe what a fake democracy looks like? I mean, you talk about neoliberalism, and you talk about a pushback against, you know, social democratic aspirations in the book, and that has something to do with why we are where we are.
Yes, I mean, it's always very hard to critique your own side, right? And so, as far as, you know, what does a fake democracy looks like, I feel like I'm critiquing this from the perspective of someone who wants a real democracy, where people are kind of substantively equal in a different kind of a way than I think they are. So that's my sort of disclaimer or you know, preamble, I think. But a fake democracy is one, well, I mean, in obviously in practice, it's different to what it is in theory. But in theory, obviously, it's a system that appears on the surface to be democratic, to be fair, to be based on equality, but that uses that appearance, that veneer, as a camouflage that enables it to maintain fundamentally undemocratic and anti-democratic structures and principles. In practice, what we have is something that is a kind of a pretty harsh, market-driven society that is based on a really fundamental kind of gospel of private gain and entrepreneurial success and a private accumulation, and that being the sort of like holy narrative of the society that we're built on. So everything has to be kind of organized according to that. And so throughout the book, I talk about the market-driven society. And I do that to try to avoid, it's not that I want to avoid neoliberalism, but I think that the word neoliberalism is again kind of polysemic and multifaceted and is used to describe lots of different pathologies, all of which are important. But I felt that to use the word neoliberalism a lot, as I did with my previous book, would fall foul to being misread and misunderstood. And I wanted to be very clear that we are talking about, you know, an entire society being captive to that sort of like, you know, that pseudo gospel of a private entrepreneurial activity and material gain at the expense of a public and a common good and other forms of value which have fallen by the wayside to make way for financial value and material value. So that's what a fake democracy has, I think. That's the version of fake democracy that we have. It's a society that's kind of seems democratic, but is captive to that narrative.
And what effect does this have on our informational ecologies? When everything is sort of made to measure the market, when the value that counts preeminently is profit, monetary value, what kind of information do we get out of that? Because we're told a lot. You know, there's a slogan, information wants to be free. And we're told a lot that there is more of an abundance of information now than ever before in human history. And that should be liberating in a way. Why is that not the case?
Well, so that's a really good question. I think the thing is that you can't just look at the information that's out there. You also have to look at the people spreading it and listening to it. And one of my sort of fundamental, if you like, research questions in writing this book was, why were we so vulnerable to fake news or the things that are called fake news, right? If you spread a rumor that, you know, I don't know, Pope Francis has endorsed Donald Trump, what is it about the kind of public spheres that we have and the conversations that we have and the forms of education, I suppose, that we have that means that people are actually likely to believe those kinds of extremely far-fetched things that, you know, Hillary Clinton eats babies or whatever, or that the climate change is made up, you know, by an international cabal. There's a vulnerability there in this fake democracy, in this market-driven society, that is the direct result of our having reconfigured what kinds of value we are willing to recognize. I work in education, and I can say for certain that, you know, part of that work involves constantly pushing back against a tide of basically reconfiguring what education is so that it only equips people to function in a marketplace. And I sound rather old-fashioned when I'm always trying to say, actually, to me, being educated is about something else. It's about something. There are other fundamentals to be recognized besides the ability to not starve in a market-driven society by making yourself valuable in a marketplace, right? There are things that are important that have that cannot be measured and have their value assessed just according to those metrics. And I think that if you reorganize a society so that for the last four decades it has been, you know, focused on one form of value, you expose the people in that society to various forms of vulnerability that come out of not having embraced things that don't have value in that society, education being a key one. And a certain sort of, I mean, I don't like to use the words education and ignorance and like that so much, but I think really the concept of literacy is very important to me, thinking about multiple forms of literacy and how we might be literate about the workings of the world, again, beyond those, the metrics of the marketplace. And I see that, or rather the lack of it, as being a key part of why misinformation has been able to spread so effectively.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and maybe we'll come back to this. I think in your discussion of fake news, you describe how, in a way, it exploits existing news values as far as their commercial news values. So, for example, the idea of novelty, cultural familiarity combined with distance. But I'll come back to that. I want to talk about vulnerability a bit more. Part of the vulnerability that you're describing, it's not just a social vulnerability per se. There is an emotional vulnerability. And at one point, you connect the susceptibility to disinformation, for example, over what Brexit or what Trump claims was a stolen election, to the sense of victimization. And here you're very clear, it isn't about who is a victim, but who feels they are a victim. So I suppose there are two questions here. Why is the sense of victimhood so widespread at the moment? And why does that make us susceptible to disinformation?
Well, again, those are really interesting questions. I mean, with the first one, you know, I think I am only partially qualified to answer that because I think it's a sort of really a social anthropology question partly and a sociology question. But what I would say is if you look at it from a, you know, political economy perspective, cultural studies perspective, I think one of the things, and this really comes out of my criticism of liberalism in the European sense of the word, that, you know, the kind of post-Cold War centrist politics that got its chance to kind of build the new world in the 90s is a politics of what I call ringing the dinner bell and not serving dinner. And by that, what I mean is it goes back to this kind of sense of there being a veneer or a camouflage. You know, previous to that time, really, I suppose, through the 50s and 60s and the Cold War, because of the nature of Russia and Russia as the main enemy, the anti-communists and the neoliberals were sort of on the same side. They were allied. So you could be an arch neoliberal and very, very pro-market and also very, very socially conservative, you know, but there was no real kind of contradiction there. And the end of the Cold War, I do think that that's started to change. And actually, it became more convenient for neoliberals to say that they were progressive and to outwardly and in a very tokenistic way, I suppose, or kind of, again, very, very insincere way, embrace a certain kind of very thin language of equality that didn't actually really mean like material or substantive or structural equality, but sounded nice and for a while had some degree of credibility as part of that sort of post-Cold War, you know, euphoria about how isn't capitalism great. And so, you know, I think if you do that and you kind of organize your society according to essentially a lie like that, you're going to do two forms of harm. One of which is that the people who are failed by that, by the shortcomings of that so-called equality, in other words, the people that are sort of at the bottom of the society, so people of color, women, etc., they're going to feel let down by that because actually their circumstances are not improved by that particularly, unless they're already well off, materially speaking. And at the same time, then you have all of the other people who have historically had a lot of privilege, who, for a variety of reasons, perhaps we don't need to get into, are more beguiled by the lie of this sort of equality, and therefore feel that they are having their historical privileges taken away, even though they in fact aren't really. But it certainly sounds like they're about to. So that's enough to kind of turn everyone against the system who isn't, you know, isn't kind of in on the ruse, if you like. And you end up organizing this kind of fantasy of you know, capitalist social democracy in a way such that it actually continues with the policies of what it replaced, but it kind of puts its flag up around helping vulnerable people, fails to do that, and turns the people who feel that they're losing their historical privilege against it. So that's the answer to your first question. Remind me what your second question was, actually, because I got...
It was actually about why the sense of victimhood leaves one vulnerable to this kind of disinformation. But I think you've actually come close to answering it there. It's just, I mean, I suppose what I was thinking about there, and this sort of brings me on to the next point, which is you have a chapter about conspiracy theories, the wake up sheeple. And you have a slightly different take on conspiracy theories to the, erstwhile defenders of reason, TM. And you are critical of QAnon and the grifters like Alex Jones, who, whatever they believe, have turned what is often male paranoia into revenue streams. But you don't just dismiss conspiracism. Rather, what you do is you identify it as a type of counterpower, albeit pretty toothless. And I suppose that raises the question of, okay, there's people feel victimized, they feel conspired against, I think you say at one point. Is there anything worth salvaging from conspiracy theories? Are they getting at an important truth? Or is this a blind alley?
I'd be very careful here. There's nothing in the narratives of conspiracy theories on the surface level that I would... But I think beneath those narratives, if we were to sort of analyze what the stories that conspiracy theories are telling us, we see a lot of suspicion. And we see a lot of suspicion directed towards a system that actually is quite conspiratorial in some ways. And I say that with caution, because I know it's going to sound like I'm saying that conspiracy theorists are right, but I'm saying they're wrong about 99.9% of what they say, but the sense they have of being suspicious because the system is in fact rigged and that there are people plotting against them may not be entirely wrong. It's just that that same failure of literacy that I mentioned earlier is something that has also prevented them from understanding those circumstances. And furthermore, has directed them, because preventing obviously is a negative thing, it's also positively directed them towards some other narrative that takes them even further away from understanding those circumstances. It made me think of Marx's camera obscura, that ideology makes man and his circumstances appear upside down. It's like these kinds of cultural and ideological functioning take us further away from being able to see what our real circumstances actually are. And so I do think that if we had given people the chance to be more literate about capitalism and about the ways in which it actually is sort of, against a lot of our interests, whether it's polluting our environment or, giving us medicines that are in some cases harmful, like the opioids crisis, or any number of other proven quite scandalous things recently. There's the sort of UK government ministers giving contracts to their friends and things like that, these sorts of things, yeah, which are quite well proven, and the list goes on. The diesel emissions scandal, Enron, the huge private profiteering out of the war in Iraq. You could make, in fact, that was the hardest bit of the chapter and of the book, was making this long, 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 long list of ways in which the system is conspiratorial. So I think that's the bit that, I don't know if salvage is the word, but I think that's the bit that we can work with. I recently wrote about anti-vaxxers, and I was trying to take a similar position there. anti-vaxxers are totally wrong about vaccines.
Yes.
Totally wrong. But they're right to be suspicious of an irreversible injection from distant people who they don't trust that have provably let them down in the past, you know, so in other ways, or who appear to be connected with others who have let them down in the past. You can see at least why there might be some reluctance there. It doesn't mean that ultimately it's a cautious or sensible thing not to have a vaccine. In fact, the more you learn about the situation, the more you realize it's important and the cautious option is absolutely to be vaccinated. It's just that there's a confused kind of blurry mess around the way people understand the world, I think, and that causes them to come to entirely the wrong conclusions about something that is ultimately instinctively it is a correct instinct.
I mean, that's interesting, because you go on to say something else about conspiracy theories, and that leads me to think that possibly we're not just talking about counterpower. And this is one of the points in the book. You say capitalism's widely felt adversarial transactionalism is a key part of the politics of suspicion. In other words, potentially anyone could stick the knife in your back.
Yes.
The air is thick with demons, as it was in the medieval period. And certainly when I think about some of the conspiracy theories that are around today, Trump's theories about Antifa, the stuff about cultural Marxism, although they have in mind some diabolical power, you know, against which the good people are ranged, quite often, concretely, they're aimed against pretty powerless people, you know, people getting shot by militias for being Antifa or whatever. And I wonder if, does that complicate your view at all? Because there's an element of, there's counter-subversion there, not just counter-power, and maybe also counter-social violence, you know, like neighborly malice and so on. Does that change the picture at all?
Well, that's really interesting. So I think that there's a kind of, yes, there is that element that if you are in a free market society and everyone's always trying to get a deal or everyone else and everything is transactional, then the basic kind of dealing with other members of the public is something that's going to at times be laced with a certain degree of suspicion towards other people. And to, you know, in particular, to be suspecting people who are trying to get one over on you for material gain. But I don't think I really connect that with or see that. I mean, I think these things can be multi-layered, and I think that these layers can be in different thicknesses in different places. So it really depends on, you know, what is the conspiracy that's being alleged and in what, you know, areas of life and for what reasons and by whom. Because there's sort of many reasons why people might be given to believing in conspiracies, and that's one. And the previous answer I gave outlines one. And I think there is this, you know, Umberto Eco talks about, obviously, the everlasting qualities of sort of eternal fascism.
Yes.
And it's a really important text for me and something that, as I'm sure you'll have seen, I used quite a lot in my book. One of the things that he outlines there, which I think is really important, is this sense of like simultaneously looking up at an elite who you believe are discriminating against you and feeling some desire for counterpower against them, or feeling sort of an inferiority complex against them. And simultaneously also having a sense of superiority about some group beneath you as well. And then often feeling that those two groups can be, you know, in allegiance. And this is what Michael Barkun calls a super conspiracy, where you have, you know, conspiracy sounding beliefs, and then you sort of put them together into one narrative in your head. QAnon is a bit like that, you know, Pizzagate, all these, they kind of have that element. Great Replacement is a bit like that also. So, I mean, I think that you can sort of be, you know, suspicious in this very misogynistic way of like, well, women are materialistic and they're gold diggers and they're out to get you, and I'm, you know, I'm an incel, and that's kind of a conspiracy belief. And that's interesting because it's got misogyny, which is looking down at women, but it's also got a sort of, some of these prejudices and bigotries that we see in conspiracy beliefs are also this sense of looking up at people who you feel look down at you. And there's also, I think, a form of misogyny that looks like that. And I also think that the anti-Semitism in many of these beliefs kind of tends to have that that element to it as well. And that's something that Umberto Eco also said. So I think, you know, that it isn't an either or. We can have conspiracy beliefs that simultaneously are bigoted about people beneath us, you know, oh, look at all the immigrants or whatever, and simultaneously, oh, but the elites are letting the immigrants come, and thus it's those of us in the middle who are being kind of squished. It isn't either or.
Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
I mean, from talking about sort of conspiracy theories and fake news, I want to sort of pivot now to the what you call the custodians of reason, liberty, enlightenment, and justice. And you say this obviously with a certain irony, the sort of moderate centrists who tend to blame technology for all our woes, but at the same time extol technology as a universal solution. And when I read this, I thought about how Facebook was scapegoated on the one hand by many American liberals for Trump's victory, but on the other hand, how Facebook easily sidestepped this type of criticism by promising to fix its algorithms. And both of these things seem to leave in place, if you like, a certain structure of power that, or indeed to tighten up a certain structure of power that we are subjected to. So I suppose, how does this almost technological approach to the facts, if that makes sense, enable disinformation and the whole ecology of disinformation?
Well, I'll come back to that, the technology part in particular. I think for me, so there was a chapter that really was wanted to come out for a long time and came out in this book, but it's almost like sometimes you have to get things off your chest. And I wanted to connect a few different dots and sort of put this kind of discourse around technology that I find so bothersome into a broader context of other forms of, you know, liberal disinformation that I thought belonged together. And, you know, there's a sort of way in which it connected in my head also with conspiracy theories, in the sense that where conspiracy theories are sort of a boiling over of that suspicion, of that sense that the system will let us down, the system doesn't really work for us, the system works for somebody else. This kind of liberal disinformation was the opposite. It was a sort of too much belief in the system and in the idea that nothing really needs to change because the systems we have basically are fine and just need tweaking. And, you know, you can see that with the way that technology is handled. You can see that with the way that law is handled. You can see that with the way that foreign policy is handled. I mean, your own work on you know, the liberal defense of murder, that book was really useful to me. But I wanted to connect that again into, you know, into a broader kind of context. You know, there's obviously Ulrich Beck. I've written this kind of stuff on, you know, the way that systems and societies manage risk, and Lacerdo. And so there's this way in which we just, like, if we carry on just believing that the system is basically fine and just needs tweaking, and, you know, that's what gives us politicians like Keir Starmer or Joe Biden or Macron, you know, they're just making kind of little changes here and there. And that's a way of not really having to change anything. And it's a way of not really having to face up to your own kind of moral inconsistencies and complicity with the problems you claim to care about. And within that, then we can go to technology and say, well, let's look at this huge edifice that's been built in the last 10, 15 years in the form of social networks, and the fact that the attention has now been directed towards the systems by which we get our information, and the idea that they may, you know, deliberately or accidentally be causing kind of widespread behavioral change as far as voting and all those kinds of things. And once again, we were focusing on the technology, and in so doing, taking attention away from the other kinds of societal issues that then wouldn't need to be changed. We were saying, well, you know, all the work of all of the sociologists who have been to the kind of Rust Belt states or the north of England or wherever to kind of understand what people are, you know, angry about is basically not even on the table. Instead, no, this is because of Facebook. That to me is a way of, I mean, even if all of that anger is wrong or conspiratorial or, you know, misguided, it's a way of not even having to listen to it or reckon with its presence at all. It's just, nope, you know, some echo chambers on Facebook are the problem, and we just need to, you know, implement a few extra lines of code, and the problem will be solved. So really, it's not a way of talking about technology. It's a way of avoiding talking about other problems, and a way of ultimately kind of doubling down on that overall belief in the system that I think so characterizes that kind of centrist liberal politics.
Well, I mean, when I mentioned the sort of technological approach to the facts, there seems to be an idea that, you know, and this is built into an idealized notion of journalism, that there are such things as uncontroversial facts, as facts that are simply beyond reproach. Now, of course, I'm sure there are some such, but facts frequently are contested. Now, you give us some good reasons in your book for thinking that the loss of public authority that journalism has experienced in recent decades is self-inflicted, and particularly with this notion of impartiality. So you can get at the facts by being impartial. And you say that's both impossible and incompatible with journalism's democratic remit. And what's worse than that, you say it's allowed fascism to enter the mainstream under the sort of rubric of it's all just a debate. But I sort of, the alternative currently appears to be news outlets and websites that establish trust by offering opinion and identity-based coverage, like Fox News or its epigony, GP News. How do we escape that kind of bind where it's either disingenuous impartiality or propaganda and overt info wars?
Well, how do we escape is always the hardest question of all. I think, to me, I wouldn't start with journalism. I think that this is a much bigger problem that's come over a much longer period of time and has many more origins. I guess I don't really see it being, though, those being the only two options on the table, though. Either we have disingenuous impartiality or we sort of all decide we're going to be Fox News. I mean, I know some of the American they call themselves left-leaning, but let's just say liberal, you know, news outlets, thinking Rachel Maddow or whatever, have also decided to essentially adopt that approach as well. Well, if Fox News can be opinionated, yeah, then we will be also. They don't have Ofcom to worry about. But it doesn't have to be only those two things, because you can, you know, you can say, well, actually, if journalism is going to take a side, it can take the side of the people. And I don't mean that in a sort of populist sense. Well, the people want this and the people want that. But nor does it need to be kind of paternalistic in terms of deciding what's best for people. But I think, you know, we have lost the sense of a common good. And that's, in a way, one of the things that kind of right-wing populism exploits and tries to speak to, even though, of course, it's doing that in a very distorted and warped and you know, knowingly incendiary way. But the reason they're able to do that is because basically the idea of a common good is otherwise largely absent or at least implicit. So I think that, you know, it's not just for journalists, but maybe for all of us to try to think a bit more about what that common good is and how else it might manifest and what it is, what forms of solidarity and belonging we owe each other. And, you know, that's why it comes back down to the question of belonging in a way, and why you can't separate this kind of informational crisis from the broader confrontation we're having with fascist discourse and with those kinds of reactionary ways of deciding the question of who belongs and who doesn't. It's not an accident that they're often dealt with at the same time, because one of my favorite political philosophers says that I disagree, so I'm not going to name them, but says that you always have to have in any democracy a constitutive we. You have to decide who's in and who's out. I personally don't agree. I think you could have a global we, a planetary humanist we, but I think, you know, again, if you're talking about questions of democracy and society, then you kind of have to be clear that you are inviting everyone in, or if not, then I guess who's in and who's out. And of the latter, right, as I say, I don't think that's the right approach. So with journalism, you know, I think there can be, and there are, some great outlets that are doing this, you know, whether or not they're getting the credit or the funding for it. But they are saying, well, actually, we work for the public. And so we, you know, we focus on defending public services. We defend on, you know, we work on other things like that, that are in the public interest, in the proper sense of the word. Obviously, within journalism regulation, there's a lot of disagreement about what the words public interest mean. But I think we know what we mean here. So, I mean, that's what journalism can do. But as I say, it's really, first, we have to solve these broader political questions. And I think that's going to be very difficult and painstaking and slow because of that entrepreneurial, you know, narrative that I mentioned earlier, and the kind of addiction that we have to that, or some of us have to that, as a way of seeing the world, and because of the sorts of division that we already have, you know, around, I mean, credibility, what you believe and what you accept to be a fact and what you don't, come down to at the moment which camp you see yourself as being in. This is why Boris Johnson faces no accountability whatsoever, because any criticism of him will appear to be from someone outside of that camp of people who are loyal to him. And therefore, it won't come from a credible source as far as the people you're trying to convince. And then we go back to square one. You said something at the beginning of your question about facts, though, and I think that's important as well, because it is language that gets used a lot, and I think rightly so. I don't want to join in with people who say there is no such thing, or facts are just social constructions or whatever. And I actually don't hear very many people really argue that. I think the thing to say there is that obviously real facts in terms of verifiable pieces of information do exist. And then, of course, we know that fact is also a social or political construction. And I think the thing to remember is that most pieces of information are both simultaneously, maybe in different proportions, but they encounter both of those two things. And so it might be verifiably true, but the way it is experienced, it also comes in political and cultural clothing. And that is, in a way, it's separating those two things is part of the challenge.
Your final chapter in this book talks about, and it returns to the subject of social media And you talk about the way its commercialized, emotionally driven logic has allowed what I guess one might call fascist disinfotainment to permeate the mainstream. And you're very clear that it's not just about, I mean, you mentioned filter bubbles and echo chambers earlier, but you're very critical of these concepts. But I suppose the question is, should we be calling for something like censorship? Should we demand that the media giants and social media companies break their commercially profitable relationship with the far right? Because, of course, as you know, this is an ongoing debate, and Twitter and Facebook have blocked and driven out various far-right accounts. But they don't look very reliable as arbiters of acceptable speech, let alone of truth. So what's the answer there?
Well, I mean, I've always argued that the whole model of Facebook and Twitter is flawed from the ground up. I just don't believe in making revisions to it or asking for them to, you know. I mean, you can ask them to moderate aspects of the content, but that is sticking plaster on an open wound. And I mean, that's probably what we're stuck with for now. But let's not look for a perfect solution where we won't find one. And the perfect solution in my world is to shut Facebook down completely. but I mean, okay, let's assume that no one else wants to do that. You know, I mean, the reason I'm critical of filter bubbles and echo chambers is because the researchers who specialize in looking at these things, whose work I use, say that they don't exist in the way that the liberal imagination that wants to make technology always the problem, like Cass Sunstein, for example, say that they're the problem. That when you actually look at the kinds of exposure that occur on social networks, you find towards the extremes, there are some types of filter bubble or echo chamber-like structures. AfD is one example. So the kind of German far right can be observed to be in sort of echo chambers, according to the work of Axel Bruns. But most people, A, they're not on social media primarily for political purposes. And even if they are, for the most part, they're exposed to a greater range of political views on social media by virtue of the fact that social media comprise something of a context collapse between your family, your chosen friends, your work colleagues, your high school friends that you don't speak to anymore, but who may have wildly divergent political views from you. And if all those people are in one place, then you are going to get a lot of different things. And my Facebook, when I had Facebook, is one of the few places where I did see Trump supporters, actually. So, I mean, like, if there are echo chambers and filter bubbles, let's talk about that. But I think otherwise it becomes a sort of like, what are the name of those kind of evil deities and sort of, you know, demons that we kind of, you know, we sort of blame it for doing something, but actually it doesn't exist, right? And actually the problem is really coming from somewhere else. And the problem is really coming from, you know, and in this chapter, I've found it really hard not to repeat some of the criticisms that I made in my prior book, which is that, you know, with social media, I think it's really clear people understand what is actually going on, right? We hear about data being sold. We hear about kind of, you know, ads and all the rest of it. No, what's happening is that your waking attention has been commodified, has been turned into something that people buy and sell for huge amounts of money. And the reason why all of this stuff is moving there is because Facebook, Twitter, all of these other companies want you to be on their networks as much as possible. If you're there discussing politics, that's fine. If you're learning dance routines on TikTok, that's fine. They don't care why you're there. They don't care what you're looking at. They don't care whether it's real good journalism or, you know, completely false news or whatever. In fact, completely false news is often more salient and interesting than the real news. Unfortunately, it's just not true. They don't really care. All of that is helpful for getting you to give them as much of your attention as possible. And then, of course, they do measure you, as is widely known, and they do collect data about your choices and your habits so that they can target that attention better with ads from more relevant advertisers. So it's just really important people know that, because, again, there's a lot of kind of narratives around, oh, Facebook want to sell your data. No, the data is way too valuable to them to ever sell it. They don't sell the data. Every second we spend on those platforms is us being exploited. And that ultimately is why they need fake news. they need all of the things they say they're interested in taking away. They actually need that for market reasons, because without that, if you just made it kind of like, I don't know, C-SPAN, you know, and BBC News and classified ads and, you know, holiday pictures, if it was really just that, like all the kind of banal stuff, no one would go on it. You know, and regulation permitting, somebody would then start some other kind of social network that did permit all of that stuff, and then they would command all the attention. And if you look at the kind of evolution of these systems, broadly speaking, right, Twitter and Facebook are come around at the same time. Twitter still manages to be relatively, and I say relatively, more rational than some of the others. Facebook then took that up a level as far as like saliency and intrusion into our lives and emotions. Then Instagram came along and sort of distilled the parts about Facebook that were most appealing to people and put that into a product that was just that. Obviously, they bought it, but that's what they turned Instagram into. And now you have TikTok, which, okay, is a different company again. I don't know how much time, Richard, you've spent on TikTok recently, but I mean, I, under lockdown, joined it because I wanted to see what it was like. And sure enough, it's a further distillation, isn't it, of all of those same processes to keep you on there. And I'm sure people spend hours, absolutely hours on there. And it's the same model. Your attention just being commodified. So they need fake news. Actually, TikTok is surprisingly heartening, I think, compared to the others, because there's a lot of people who are very interested in explaining the world in quite a reliable way, you know, in a relatively entertaining way as well. So I always find it's a lot better than, you know, the bizarre YouTubers and people on Instagram that you come across. Yeah. So, I mean, that's I think, what Absolutely. The way we need to look at social networks.
And that brings us full circle back to the whole question of the market-driven society. It's been absolutely fascinating. I want to thank you, Marcus, for a great discussion. The book, again, for readers is called After the Fact, and it is outstanding. I've been Richard Seymour, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.
Thank you so much.